This is Sci-Fi for Me.
All right, welcome to another episode of H2O. This is the show where Mr. Timothy Harvey and I opine about various different topics. My name is Jason Hunt. I'm the editor at sci-fi4me.com. And today we are going to stray a little bit outside of genre, although not really. A while back, Emma Coates, who was a story artist for Pixar, she posted on her Twitter feed various different rules that she had learned at Pixar. These are the 22 rules of storytelling, and I imagine you've probably seen them various different places on the internet. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through all 22 of those, and we're going to tie them in with science fiction examples, most of them being what not to do. It's funny, we were coming up with this list. It's like, okay, well, here's this rule. Well, this film broke that rule. Here's this rule. Well, this film broke that rule. So this is going to be more of a...
And they suffered for it, too. I think that's the point, is that they, by ignoring these what are really common sense rules of storytelling, it costs them in terms of just the quality of the story or the audience or the success of their film.
Yeah, and I think too that if you look at these films as examples of errors, then you know maybe it's a cautionary tale for some of the stuff that's still in development that has yet to be done.
Well, sometimes some of these films are actually, some of the films we're going to mention are very successful films.
Well, yeah.
But you're going to look at it and see that some of the consistent criticisms of those films are the places where they sat there and from just a storytelling standpoint, they kind of let themselves and the audience down.
You know, that seems to be a recurring theme with a lot of our discussions going back to the story. I wonder if there's a reason for that.
Possibly because... No reason whatsoever.
No. Okay, so this discussion is fueled by chocolate chip cookies and Dr. Pepper. So we'll see how far we digress.
If we start talking faster and faster and faster and faster and faster.
That's right.
Could be why.
You know, we could do a cappuccino, an espresso, you know, really highly caffeinated version of this at some point. Okay, so first rule. You admire a character for trying more than for their successes. And I think we came up with an example of how this is done well.
Oh, yes.
In The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, it's an entire film where our heroes fail. They succeed. Their biggest success in the entire thing is that they don't give up.
Yeah.
But they lose on almost every conceivable front. They lose Hoth. They lose... Luke doesn't finish his training. Han Solo gets frozen. Luke loses the fight to Vader. These are spoilers, by the way, in case you somehow managed to miss the... And it's widely regarded as the best of the Star Wars films.
Well, I would say, too, that Luke loses his innocence in this film as well.
Yeah, definitely. His entire worldview is yanked out from underneath him. It's a film where they are the heroes we want them to be in every conceivable way, and they don't succeed. I mean, they are literally failing at every turn.
Right. The only one character that actually succeeds at something he sets out to do is R2-D2 when he turns the hyperdrive back on.
Well, you know.
You know. But these movies are all about R2 and 3PO anyway, right?
Right. Yeah. Uh-huh. Sure they are.
Sure they are. Okay, moving on. Rule number two. You got to keep in mind what's interesting to you as an audience, not what's fun to do as a writer. They can be very different.
Oh, yeah.
And we go back to Star Wars for this one as well, because George Lucas wrote a story that he wanted to tell that the audience didn't necessarily connect with.
That would be called Episode One.
Are we being generous
with that?
We're
being generous, I think. But at the same time, it's true. I mean, we're not saying you can't do that. As a filmmaker and a storyteller, you're going to want to tell the story you're going to want to tell.
Sure.
But you have to recognize that if you're playing in an existing world, your audience has an expectation of this.
Especially when hints of the past have been placed in the first three films.
Right.
There is an expectation based on the information that's already out there.
Right. And we can, however you feel about the prequels, they don't really match
nope.
what we were told for in 4 through four through six, and I think that that's one place that the additional films end up really doing a disservice to the original trilogy.
And it raises the question of what episode seven is going to be like, whether it's really going to be consistent with the original trilogy. And given the fact that Kathleen Kennedy has already come out saying it's going to be a mix of CG and models, mm-hmm. practical models, and you've got Lawrence Kasdan involved as mm-hmm. a story consultant, which I thought was very good news.
Very good news indeed.
Simon Kinberg also involved. Mm-hmm. You've got an Oscar winner writing the script who has not worked for J.J. Abrams before. So, you know, that's encouraging.
Yeah, and even if you're not the biggest J.J. Abrams fan and you're looking at Star Trek and the Star Wars films are making you nervous, remember, Abrams is a Star Wars fan. He was not a Star Trek fan.
Yeah.
That could be good, that could be bad, but the fact of the matter is he's looking at those films in a way that he was not looking at the Star Trek movies, and that's just
a potential positive. Yeah,
I think
Abrams is more of a fan of the Mystery Box than he is of Star Wars even.
Well,
because everything he does is filtered through that Mystery Box mentality. And
you want to explain the Mystery Box to the folks at home?
Well, yeah, there's a TED Talk that he gave where he talks about this, his interest in magic mm-hmm. as a kid. I think what was his uncle had a bunch of stuff. Mm-hmm. So he's got this one trick that he bought at a magic store. It's a Mystery Box. There's something inside the box, and he's never opened it. And to him, it's an example of all of the different possibilities that exist within the storytelling. And he feels like he would spoil everything if he opened the Mystery Box. And so that basically informs his approach to marketing a movie, to different elements in the story. You're just supposed to take things at face value, and that works to the detriment of some of his stories. But you know, given that so many other people related to the original trilogy are back, I think he's going to have some limits that he's got to work with to stay consistent with those other films. At least I hope so.
Yeah, I think there's a good reason to have hope there.
All right, so number three is the only one that I think has kind of got a stump. Trying theme is important, but you won't see what the story is actually about until you're at the end of it. Now rewrite.
Well, I think it's great.
It's true for anybody.
Yeah, it's fantastic advice, but having a film or a television show or something where you could sit there and say, this is an example of that, because by the time that we see it, they've already worked that out. They've figured out what the theme is. And you don't hear too much about a television show or a film that they started, we were going to make a whole different show about a whole different thing.
Doctor Who. Doctor Who started out as a children's historical show,
kind of.
Aztec years ago. I mean, you've got
But that was something that actually evolved in the course of the first season. That was actually something that was, you know, they were already evolving. It's not like the, you know, in this, in terms of storytelling, in terms of, and I guess
it's not technically, it's not a rewrite.
But you know, but what? That is a good example. I think I don't know how we just missed that. Is that basically you actually got to watch that show do that in the course of its first season. Okay. It's go from being an educational program into being a children's adventure program.
Yeah, which now is not really so much children's adventure. It's evolved
still classified
even over
as
the
a children's 50, program.
Is it still really?
It's still classified as a children's program.
Wow. All right, rule number
four.
Very
large children.
Once upon a time, there was blank. Every day, blank. One day, blank. Because of that, blank. Because of that, blank. Until finally, blank.
This is every good and every bad film there ever was. Every good novel, every good comic book, everything. It's all about this. It is, here's the situation. Here's how it changed.
Yeah.
Here's what, you know, it's all those things that basically take you from A to B to C to D in a story. And if you miss one of these things, you've done something.
And I'm going to put out as an example of this that is just recent. It's kind of a fun story. It's Clockwork Angels, the novel by Kevin J. Anderson, which mm-hmm. is built around the new Rush album. This is something that Anderson and Neil Peart have been looking for an opportunity to develop for a long time, and the book is actually really good. And it is somewhat predictable in a couple of places only because it's that kind of story where certain things must happen to your hero.
Sure.
It's kind of a hero's journey Campbell thing. But it's done really well, and it's in a nice steampunky environment that is not a dystopian environment like we see so many of the, you know, the current science fiction things done. So I'm going to recommend Clockwork Angels. If you haven't read it, I haven't listened to the album yet, but the book is pretty good. And say what you will about Kevin Anderson, I think he's a decent writer.
He's a decent writer.
All right, number five. Simplify, focus, combine characters, hop over detours. You'll feel like you're losing valuable stuff, but it sets you free. Green Lantern did not do this.
Oh my.
And I mean, what needs to be said? It's three stories in one.
Right.
And we've said this before, they tried to tell three different movies with that film.
I mean, yeah, it's one thing to try and get as much into that first film because you don't know if you're going to get a second film, right? But at the same time, there's a limit that you can pack things in.
Right.
Before you end up with story mud. There's too much that happens, and that film needed to be trimmed down. And it was a question of story.
Well, and I don't know that it was so much the fact that it needed to be trimmed so much as it needed to be focused.
Well,
you
almost have to prune. You have to prune that story down because there's too many things going on.
Yeah.
And
whichever story you end up deciding to tell that more. You're going to have to add detail to that one. But yeah, you're right. There's two pieces of that film that need to come out. Which two pieces?
The urge to go on a small rant about that, about just, you know, a wasted opportunity in a film is going to be passed up by him. Moving on.
Rule number six. What is your character good at, comfortable with? Throw the polar opposite at them. Challenge them. How do they deal? Blade Runner, I think, is a good example
of that. It's an excellent example.
Because you have Deckard, who has spent most of his adult life hunting and hating replicants. And now he's thrown into a situation where not only is he chasing replicants that he may end up sympathizing with, but he's also got one that he falls in love with.
Yeah, and I think that it's one of those situations where a good story where you've turned the world of that character around and they have to adapt to it. And I think it becomes something that, by making it personalized, that conflict, making that not just a general vague conflict, but it's a specific conflict to your own personal worldview or the way you deal with things, it adds much more depth to the characters.
Well, and even raising the question that Deckard could be a replicant himself.
Sure, and that just depends on which version of the film you want to go with.
The one with the unicorn.
You two versions fight to the death.
Well, there's more than two.
I know.
I think there's...
But really, do you want to see multiple versions fighting at the same time? No, you get one at a time, and then they narrow them down until finally you have the last version. Never mind.
Yeah. All right. Rule number seven. Come up with your ending before you figure out your middle. Seriously, endings are hard. Get yours working up front. We've got some examples of how that didn't happen.
Yes.
Battlestar Galactica.
It's hard to do a long-term series. Nobody making a long-term series is going to argue with the fact that it is, you never know if you're going to get a second next season.
Well, and even
all these things to worry about, but at the same time, you're always building towards an ending.
Yeah.
And you saw it in Battlestar Galactica, you saw it in Lost. Some people are happy with the Battlestar Galactica ending. Some people are happy with the Lost ending.
I haven't seen too many people happy with either.
The unhappy people are very, very vocal.
Very vocal.
I'm sure there's somebody who's happy. There has to be. Law of averages says there has to be somebody happy with those endings.
And not so much with Lost, but with Battlestar Galactica, it really feels like that whole ending was made up on the spot. And I can see where they've got pieces of it, and I know Ron Moore has said they'd planned it that way all along, and everything fine. Okay, but it just doesn't hold up.
Well, it's a weak ending for a show that was very much about
terrible ending about
the personal dynamics between characters, the horrors of war. There was a grittiness and a reality to that show that really made it popular. And when you get to an ending where basically it's kind of a hand-wavy angel thing.
Yeah, the mysticism just really...
And I'm not saying you can't have mysticism in it. There was a lot of mysticism in the original show. But this
The original show had more of that
This show has pulled back. I mean, the reboot pulled back from the mysticism in a lot. And that's fine. But and reincorporating it is great, too. Mm. But you can't all do it at the end when all of a sudden it's like, oh, wait, what?
Yeah.
Gods of Kobol, what?
What?
And then, of course, Lost is a great example of a show that there was never going to be an ending that was going to satisfy the audience.
Probably
just wasn't.
Not.
But the reality is that whole ending feels kind of like it's, oh, we're out of time.
And that does...
And I didn't hate the ending, but...
Well, and the Battlestar Galactica ending kind of feels that way, too. It's suddenly, you know, we've been canceled, now we've got to come up with an end.
Gods of Kobol, yay!
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or you get an example like Chuck, where... They thought they were only going to have 13 episodes. They get picked up for another 6, and now what do we do? You know, those kind of things. You have an ending in mind.
For most of it, but then you. I think Chuck actually went. If I was okay with the final episode of Chuck.
Yeah.
I thought it was actually for what they were kind of left with. It was a solid final hour. But
Okay. So rule number eight. Finish your story, let go, even if it's not perfect. In an ideal world, you have both, but move on, do better next time. Star Trek, the motion picture.
Yeah.
Not necessarily so much the fact that the writers didn't get the story finished, but so much the fact that the movie didn't get finished the way it should have been, because it had a hard, fixed release date.
Mm-hmm.
And it will get done, regardless of whether it's done.
And they were in post-production, and then the effects weren't finished, and the story wasn't, the edit, wasn't, well, all that stuff wasn't
and
done.
And the prints were shipped out wet. They still had the processing chemicals on them. I mean, it was very last minute.
Yeah. And it's a film that actually, when they came back, I mean, they actually do the director's cut.
Oh, it's so much better.
Yeah, and it's a longer cut. For those of you who thought the Star Trek the motion picture was too long and you haven't seen the director's cut, it's like 2 minutes longer, 3 minutes longer, and it flows so much better. You can see what the intention was with the film, and they just ran out of time.
And it's even, you know, even the little things like the sound mix
make
it a much better film, because they actually were able to do one. The when it was released in the theaters, there was no sound mix. There was no, even the opening titles were just text on a card, boom, boom, and they show up. There's nothing to it at all.
Yeah.
It was nice to finally see that finished.
Well, and to allow the director to take the time and do it. I think the Donner cut of Superman 2 is an example of
much
something
better.
That you can get a feel for what at least the intentions were.
Yeah. Okay, rule number 9. When you're stuck, make a list of what wouldn't happen next. Lots of times the material to get you unstuck will show up. And we're talking about Man of Steel for this, with regard to what the character should do, wouldn't do, couldn't do, might do, and there's a lot of back and forth about Superman killing.
Mm-hmm.
Spoilers. Where, you know, the ending of Man of Steel has rubbed a lot of fans the wrong way.
Yes.
And, yes, I know people can make the argument that Superman has killed before, but it's a rare exception that proves the rule, in my thought. And every time it happens, there are consequences.
Right.
Which we may or may not see
see it in Man of Steel. And I think that what we end up, you know, really asking there is the question isn't, you know, it's not Superman doesn't kill. It's that Superman shouldn't kill. And I think that it's a case of, you know, should this happen? You know, and if it does happen, should there be consequences? And that will free you up a lot of the questions of your storytelling. Because, I mean, really, yeah, if you're going to tell that story, let the consequences be there.
Well, and I think Man of Steel 2 will probably have that. It has to have that.
If they do it right. It should.
Yeah. All right. Rule number 10. Pull apart the stories you like. What you like in them is a part of you. You've got to recognize it before you can use it. I think...
We bashed episode 1, but episode 4 is a prime example of how to do this right.
Or as we saw it, Star Wars. And that's all it was. I think you know, taking the various different elements from the serials of the 30s and 40s and that whole adventure time, you know, Buck Rogers, Flash Gordon stuff, really works in the original Star Wars trilogy and in the Indiana Jones films, mm-hmm. because they all follow the 10-minute rule.
Well, they recognize what was made those film, what made those episodic storytelling, what when it made those exciting for the people who were watching them in the theaters.
Yeah, it's over-the-top adventure and fun stuff.
And I think where they went wrong in the prequels was that they lost that sense of that. They lost that sense of wonder entirely.
Well, I think the prequels, too, were more of a look what we can do with our computers now. Rather than,
which is why they were very pretty, stuff. And that's some of the nicest things you can say about the.
Yeah.
Okay, there are good moments in the prequels, but still.
Yeah, still. Rule number 11, putting it on paper lets you start fixing it. If it stays in your head, a perfect idea, you'll never share it with anyone. And you were talking about Prometheus.
Well, sure. You can actually go online and find both scripts. You can find the original script to Prometheus, and then you can find the rewrite that they did. And this is, their goal was, whether you agree with it or not, the goal was is to make it less of an alien film and more of its own, set in the same universe, but not the same thing.
Which is understandable.
It's understandable. But if you go and you look at the original script, it's very much an alien film. And there are parts about the original script which are really kind of interesting and would have made for, in a lot of people's opinion, and mine too, a better film. But they wanted to do something different, so you can actually see these two things side by side. The only way to find out that they wanted to make those decisions to make it less of an alien film was for someone to write down the script and turn it in. The only way you can figure out the film you're going to make or it's the story you're going to tell is to do it. Write it down.
Well, and we've seen that with a number of how many Superman movies have been written and never produced.
And then you look at them and go, yeah, this isn't going to work.
And Wonder Woman movies that have been written and never produced.
Should be produced.
Yeah, we don't know. We haven't seen the scripts.
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure that if, you know, I suspect Whedon's script is pretty good. I would think.
Well,
given the evidence we have to this to date.
You know, Joss Whedon is such a hit and miss, and, you know.
Can't do anything,
you know,
right.
It's all luck.
Nobody is going to give him a film series.
All right, rule number 12. Discount the first thing that comes to mind, and the second and third, fourth, fifth, get the obvious out of the way. Surprise yourself.
Mm-hmm.
We've bashed the prequels a lot for not doing that.
Yeah, we have.
Another one is Defiance on Sci-Fi.
Very tropey.
Very tropey. And I'm going to go out on a limb. I think that it's deliberately tropey because it's a commercial for a video game. And you're going to have that universal, here's what the video game has thing, mm-hmm. that goes into the TV show. And the TV show has to have those things that you would expect to find in the video game.
It's certainly possible.
So it's not going to be anything unexpected because it's essentially.
So you're basically saying it's not going to get any better, is it?
No, it's not. I don't think it will. But you know, it's going to be one of those things that it will probably last longer than 5 years, sadly. Because it's not good. It'll last longer. You know, all the good shows, 5 years, mm-hmm. and done. So, right. I don't know. All right, rule number 13. Give your characters opinions. Passive, malleable, might seem likable to you as you write, but it's poison to the audience. Avengers,
really good example. There's a lot of conflict in that film, a lot of people disagreeing with each other. And these are the good guys. These are the guys who are there. The heroes,
yeah,
they're fighting with each other regularly because they all have clear opinions. Watchmen's
a good example.
Watchmen, for however you felt about the film, and I'm one of those people who actually thought it was the best adaptation we could hope for. There are unlikable characters in that film with very clear opinions, and they're the good guys. Rorschach is not a nice guy.
No, I mean, he's clearly mentally unbalanced.
But he's a gripping character, and he's got opinions. And
well, and the comedian, too. Mm-hmm. Comedian is a terrible person.
Yeah.
But is an interesting character.
Yeah, and so I think that, you know, these are clear, you know, of course, this is Alan Moore. This is not someone who's afraid to put unpleasant opinions in the mouths of his characters. But it's very well done, and I think it translated well to the screen.
Right. Okay, rule number 14. Why must you tell this story? What's the belief burning within you that your story feeds off of? That's the heart of it. These movies that we're attaching to this particular rule are not following this rule.
Right.
J.J. Trek, I call it J.J. Trek, all right, the 2009 version of Star Trek, and now Star Trek Into Darkness,
mm-hmm.
Man of Steel,
mm-hmm.
Maybe Tron Legacy a little bit.
Sure.
But not so much because it actually felt like it had kind of an ending. These movies have been told in order to tell another movie.
Well, that's actually our hope, because what otherwise if you watch the first two Star Trek films, the first two of the reboot, this is a spoiler for the ending of the second film. It takes you to the place that the TV show started in, which is our crew off going to explore the universe on a 5-year mission. That's how the second film ends. It took us two feature films to get to the place we all want to go.
Right.
Which is our crew of the Enterprise getting out there and exploring the galaxy.
That's making the assumption that
the third film
is going to do that and do the space exploration thing, right. You know, Strange New Worlds and all of that, rather than another action picture.
But if anything else, I mean, if you're just looking at where the stories they've told in these first two films, that's a very logical assumption of where they've gone. Whether or not we get where you were supposed to go at this point is a good question, and it'll honestly determine, I think, for many, many fans of Star Trek, whether or not, doesn't matter how successful these films are,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be whether or not we're even going to bother. Because it's got, you know, you can, if you're not telling the stories, if you don't get yourself to that point, you will have lost even the folks who, like me, who are giving this, you know, these films a lot more benefit than a lot of really, really hardcore fans. And that, I don't know. It can be a real problem. And Man of Steel,
the same way.
It's, you know, we got the origin story we didn't necessarily need to get, and we basically got Superman Begins as opposed to Superman.
Right.
And it's a
completely different Superman, and it's a Superman based on distrust. I'm not going to say dishonesty so much. It's just the fact that this particular version of Kal-El doesn't believe in humanity.
That's a terrible starting point. He's got this very schizophrenic confused relationship with humanity. On one hand, he seems to think that they're worth fighting for and saving.
But why?
But at the same time, he doesn't. It's if the second film doesn't give us a scene where Superman and Batman actually have a discussion about the nature of humanity, which every great introduction of these characters actually has included in the comic books.
Yes.
If they don't give us that scene, they're really doing the fans a disservice.
Well, I'm still of the opinion that the whole Batman Superman combo was a last minute decision. I think it was a panic decision. I think Warner Brothers looked at the fan reaction to Superman killing Zod, and they said, "We need a big shiny to distract them." And oh, Batman!
I really think that
was not the original plan. That's just me. I mean, that's a personal opinion.
Part of the problem is that we keep questioning whether or not there is an actual plan for DC's cinematic universe. So,
well, there's that. All right, rule number 15. If you were your character in this situation, how would you feel? Honesty lends credibility to unbelievable situations. I've got Avatar written down for this. Because really, I mean, how many of us are going to identify with Sam Worthington's character, disabled, military, completely, and it's another fish out of water type of story. I don't know. I mean, really, I mean, the idea here that, you know, if you were your character, how would you react? Well, there are certain things where you can't really put yourself in that place because you don't have that kind of experience.
Well, but I think the really hard, bottom line of that is how to make your characters relatable. You have to believe in your characters. You have to believe their decisions are going to be logical ones that are going to, you know, follow from your character.
And the characters don't necessarily have to believe what you believe as a writer.
Right, exactly.
Their personal beliefs don't figure into
it. Right, right. No, not at all. I mean, you can have very, very horrible characters. They're just horrible people. But you understand the motivations. I think that it's...
I think that's one of the reasons why villains are so popular for actors to play.
Oh, sure.
Actors want to play the villains because they can get in their head and they can make them relatable, mm-hmm. in a way that, you know, the heroes sometimes you don't get.
There's a reason Darth Vader is an incredibly powerful and popular villain. There's a reason, and it's not Jake Lloyd. No offense to Jake Lloyd or Christian.
Well, they didn't play Darth Vader.
Well, I know, but the thing is that, you know, it's not about Anakin Skywalker, it's about Darth Vader. And so I think that that's an example of how not to do it, because they went back and tried to make us relate to that character in a way that wasn't as the villain.
And I think that's really a product of...
defeated the purpose.
...our time.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so much now, especially, you know, even in the real world, in the media, where you have these people that do... horrific things, you know, going all the way back to where the Menendez brothers is a good example of that. Columbine.
I think that's a function of us trying to understand
because we didn't have the
instant news.
Right, but as a consequence of that, in trying to explain away these really bad things that people do, now it affects our storytelling because now our bad character, our bad villains, evil people who really do despicable, terrible things.
You want to understand.
You want to understand them and you want to empathize with them. And sometimes you don't do that with villains. Villains are sometimes just enough that they're evil,
mm-hmm.
and they're bad people.
Yeah.
And we don't need the psychoanalyzing to make them.
I think it's a balance, because if you have a villain who has no motivation other than they're just evil, it is harder now for our audiences to buy that. That's because of the world the world we live in and what we've gone through over the past, you know, 30, 40 years of the world we live in and just changes in storytelling. But I think that, yeah, I think there's
I suppose.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you're not going to be able to do stuff like the old Flash Gordon serials where you just have a bad guy just for the sake of having a bad guy.
And I would love to see a fantastic version of Ming come back.
Yes. All right, rule number 16. What are the stakes? Give us a reason to root for the character. What happens if they don't succeed? Stack the odds against them. So, Man of Steel does this fairly well.
Yeah. And I think that
For all its flaws,
one of the things that is hard to do in every comic book writer who's ever written for Superman is going to say he's a hard character to write for, because he, quite frankly, he's always the strongest guy in the room. You know, there are consequences for this kind of storytelling, but basically they gave, you know, Superman someone to fight against where there was a real significant threat. You know, the planet was threatened, he was threatened, everyone around was threatened. You know, where they took that can be certainly and will be and has been debated. But the fact of the matter is they gave real consequences to and a real threat to a character who's hard to write a threat for.
Right.
As much as I love the Gene Hackman just is not a credible threat. I'm sorry. not in that context, not in those films. And there was, you know, it was a product of the time, again, compared to the product of time, but Zod and Ursa and it was different then. They didn't have this. There's, as much as we love those films, I think it would be very, very hard for an audience to buy that they are the threat. If Superman 2 came out now. And that's just, I think it's a product of the way that storytelling evolves.
Mm-hmm.
But... you know, there are problems there, but at the same time, it still works. You have a threat for Superman.
Fifth Element is another one.
Yeah, end of the world universe.
End of the universe.
Shut down the whole universe.
Multipass. Multipass will fix everything.
Oh, of course.
Right. All right. Okay. Rules. Where are we at? 17.
17.
No work is ever wasted. If it's not working, let go and move on. It'll come back around to be useful later. Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Definitely. And as someone who loved the movie.
I thought it was fun.
It is so funny.
It was fun.
It still ends up being something that was not a critical success. The audiences did not come to see it in droves. But he turned around and used that idea and the basics of the character and gave a series that ran for years and years and years and developed
and is still running in the comic books.
Huge fan base. And yeah, and it hasn't stopped telling those stories.
And I think, too, that Buffy opened the door for Joss Whedon to do a lot of other things.
Oh, sure.
That he wouldn't otherwise be able to.
Definitely. He proved what he could do there, and it made it, you can dot the line all the way to Avengers.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Which we will be doing a podcast about. See how I did
nice
that?
Nice little plug in
yes,
there. Very good. Very good.
Another one, we talk about Green Lantern. They probably had a bunch of stuff in the film that they should have pulled out and not used and saved it.
Yeah,
for
you could have done a trequel, three films.
A trequel.
You could have done three films out of the information they crammed into that, and they probably should have.
Yeah. Rule number 19, coincidences to get characters into trouble are great. Coincidences to get them out of it are cheating. That's what we used to call Deus Ex Machina.
Yes, and there is a grand tradition of that particular effect happening in all literature, let alone science fiction. Doesn't make it good at all.
Right.
Star Trek.
J.J. Trek is a good... It's a good example of both.
Yeah, because
really,
the opening bit of the film, the first 5 minutes of the film,
was good.
Was very good. The odds of the villain's ship and the parents of the hero's ship appearing so close together and being having this whole, you know, the vastness of space, it's clearly a coincidence.
Now,
however,
it's a coincidence only if you haven't read the comic book that led up to it,
right?
Which nobody, you know, not everybody saw. So,
sure.
Yeah,
so if you only
saw it
in the
theater,
it does
work as a coincidence.
But even then, you know, that's the kind of coincidence in storytelling that you can actually sit there and say, okay, because that's something that is taking you, and you know, so much conflict in the film is coincidence.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
In storytelling of any kind, our characters have to cross paths with whatever, and if you look at it long enough, it's like, well, that's all a coincidence. Mm-hmm. So that actually works. However, Jim Kirk getting exiled to the ice planet with the Vulcan he needs to talk to, which is in viewing sight of, you know, eye viewing eye line of a planet being sucked into a black hole.
Right.
What?
Yeah.
You know, that's actually called sloppy script writing.
Oh, very.
And it's coincidence for the sake of driving a story forward.
Well,
the
and then even having the magic transporter.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. It's bad writing, and it's exactly what this is talking about.
All right, now, rule 20. Exercise, take the building blocks of a movie you dislike. How do you rearrange them into what you do like? And people who, a really good example of this, Belated Media has done this for the first two movies of the Star Wars prequels. Mm-hmm. They haven't done the third one yet. But you watch those, and they pull everything apart and put it back together in a way that actually works.
Which is kind of scary to realize that all the pieces are there.
Yeah.
It's just they're in the wrong order.
Yeah, and according to these guys, and I like the way they approach it, this prequel trilogy should have been about Obi-Wan's arc rather than Anakin.
Mm-hmm.
Because Obi-Wan has to face the consequences of what happens in Star Wars.
Right.
You know, because he's... You know, he's having to deal with the fallout of it. But in this trilogy, if you put the focus on Kenobi, then you have the loss of his past with the death of Qui-Gon. Spoilers. The loss of his present because he can't have any relationships, and you know, Anakin is falling away from him, and you have the war starting and all this other stuff in the middle, and then the loss of his future with Anakin's fall into being Darth Vader and going into the dark side of the Force. So and that actually makes a lot of sense to take all of the and you're right, all of the pieces are there. They just rearrange them and put them in, you know,
where they should have gone in the first place.
Where they should have gone in the first place. So we'll put a link to that one. But those are pretty good examples of how to take the pieces of something you don't like and rearrange them into something that works. Rule 21, you got to identify with your situation and characters. Can't just write cool. What would make you act that way? We've mentioned Joss Whedon before. He does a really good job of writing relatable characters.
Who are also cool.
Who are also cool. And putting some cool dialogue in their mouths.
Mm-hmm.
And giving us situations that we can totally buy into. For the most part.
Well, and it's something where you even extraordinary and out of this, you know, completely crazy out of this world situations, the characters are relatable. They're somebody who could be you, if you happen to be Tony Stark, you know, if you happen to have the right money or the right toys or the drive to defend your country like Steve Rogers did and you know, you make these characters believable interacting with each other, even when they're extraordinary characters.
Yeah.
You know, the characters in Firefly, if you break them all down, they're pretty, pretty ordinary people.
And even with in Avengers, you know, Phil Coulson is just as believable a character as mm-hmm. a regular, normal, non-super human being
sure.
as all of the Avengers characters are believable.
And he's been rewarded really with his own television show.
Yes. He's come back to life.
But the bottom line there, of course, is you have to be able to relate to the characters. If your audience can't relate to the characters,
they're not gonna
care. There's not gonna know. The reason that Joss Whedon has the reputation for killing off characters we all love is because he made you love them in the first place.
Wait, he kills off characters?
Did I forget to say spoilers?
What?
Oops.
What?
Yeah.
What characters are dead? Who's dead?
I've said too much.
Is Buffy dead?
I've said too much.
Well, and then you get into something like Dollhouse,
mm-hmm.
which had a very small following, very loyal following,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, in other shows you can see this, not necessarily with Joss Whedon stuff, but you see shows, especially genre, where it's not necessarily the audience that doesn't get it, it's the network that doesn't get it.
Well, that's a whole other show.
They don't identify with the characters,
and that's a show we should do because we there are several series that we know that are really really quality.
Yeah,
science fiction series, whether it's, you know, not just American television shows from around the world that were killed by a network because they just didn't understand what they had.
Yeah, or then you get something like Defiance, which is never going to die because the network's so invested in it.
That's a completely different model right there.
All right, last rule. What's the essence of your story? Most economical telling of it. If you know that, you can build out from there. And I think a couple of good examples of this, the economy of storytelling. Back to the Future,
mm-hmm.
the first one.
Yes.
Because they wrote that as a standalone film.
Right.
It was not supposed to be a trilogy. There was never supposed to be a second film. It was just one and done, and popular.
You know, and this is a good way to write a script. This is a good way. You may not get a sequel.
Although, you know, they've said time and time again, if they'd known they were going to do a second one, they would never put Jennifer in the car, because that created a whole half of the second film that they had to deal with her
one of the reasons that film works so well is because it is a story. It is not the first part of a story.
Right.
It is a story. And
exactly.
I think that, you know, we're seeing, you know, we're not worrying about the sequel. We're not worrying about, we're just telling our story right now. If it's a bigger part of a bigger story, even better. But
Raiders of the Lost Ark is another one,
mm-hmm.
because the sequel technically was a prequel.
Right.
And you're not telling a story to tell a story. I think you're right. I think we're too wrapped up now in film series, Harry Potter, Star Trek, Star Wars. You know,
nothing wrong with being committed to telling a multi-part series.
But they have to be self-contained.
But you have to be. You can't leave, because if you don't get that second film, then you have to make sure that you're left your audience with that first film that where they've got a beginning, a middle, and end.
And Tron Legacy does that.
It does.
Because we know that it's going into another story. There's going to be a third film.
Right.
But Tron Legacy by itself holds up, for the most part, as mm-hmm. a standalone film.
Well, and even though we look at them as being something where their larger arc is poorly planned out at this point, you know, there is a beginning and a middle and end to the two Star Trek movies. There's a beginning, middle, and end to Man of Steel. But it feels like there's pieces missing in between. And mm-hmm. then you feel like, you know, oh, You've told two films to tell us, get us to the third film?
Yeah.
And what are you doing there?
So. Speaking of pieces that that are left out, we skipped Rule 18.
Did we skip Rule
18? We skipped a rule. We skipped Rule 18. Rule 18. You have to know. Well, it's not in my order on my page. See, because I scratched.
We are very bright boys.
Yes.
What, pray tell, is Rule 18?
Rule 18. You have to know yourself, the difference between doing your best and fussing. Story is testing, not refining. I think an example of this would be Sam Raimi and Spider-Man 3, mm-hmm. where the suits told him he had to include Venom, and he originally didn't want to because it would bog down the story, which it did.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of those things where, you know, Raimi knew his own thoughts about it, had his own opinions about it, and should have stuck with it. I mean, he really should have drawn the line and said, no, I'm not going to put Venom in. We do that in the fourth one.
Yeah, it would have been a better story, and because I think that there's multiple things that flowed from including that character, just that damaged the story as we went along.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was one of those things, like you saw with Green Lantern, trying to do too much mm-hmm. in the same film. And I think, you know, the studio telling him that you had to include Venom, I mean, that's the story anyway.
Right.
That's what we hear. And, you know, the studio coming in saying, fans are clamoring for Venom, so it's your fault, everyone. But then that raises the question of how much influence we as an audience have over the writer in terms of expectations for the next story.
Well, to some degree, there is going to be that, because people are going to look at them and say, you know, the people who are hiring the writer are telling them, this is what the fans want, this is what we want from you.
Yeah.
And it's very rare that the writer is going to sit there and say, that's not what I'm going to write, because you're paying me to, you know, you're paying me. You know, mm-hmm. it's a job. And if, unless you're coming in and you own that script and you're the director, you've got the control,
right.
You know, and even then the studio's going to have, you know, there's the idea that the studio is not going to tell you what they want is, you know, kind of naive. So, it's unfortunate, but yeah. It can happen.
Well, and I'm going to tell you what we want.
Yes.
As we close out on this one, we would like, and it's not going to be a demand, of course, but you know, we would like for you to subscribe to all of our feeds.
Yes, please.
Besides the podcast here at Sci-Fi for Me Radio, we also have this little thing we call Sci-Fi for Me TV, which is our video stuff on YouTube. You can find it at youtube.com/sci-fi-for-me. And we've got a number of shows there. We've got a semi-regular weekly headlines digest of mm-hmm. you know, all the latest news. We've got a couple of video game-related news programs, a Star Wars show, comic book show, comic book movie show. We've got a number of different programs there that, you know, whatever your taste is, we probably will have something to address it. We're also on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and you can find our main site, of course, at scififorme.com. And the podcast, you can subscribe either through the RSS feed on the site or through the iTunes directory. You can find us at Sci-Fi for Me Radio. And I think that's going to do it for us this time.
All right. Well, I think the important thing that it all comes down to is just tell good stories.
Tell good stories.
If you could just do that, then everyone will be happy.
Are you listening, Sci-Fi?
Everybody will be happy. Don't you want everyone to be happy?
All right, we're going to head out. Thanks for joining us for another episode of H2O. Don't forget, we are going to have a podcast on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., so be listening for that. And lots of other stuff still yet to come.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed.
All right, we'll see you later.
Thanks for listening, folks.
This has been a presentation of scififorme.com.